They're watching to see what you do next.
Beyond Northern Ireland.
Hey everybody, we're back. It's 2022, Beyond NI. Hope you didn't miss us too much. The reason for our extended break was there was no political news worth talking about.
Oh yeah, nothing happened in the whole month.
No, it was just we both been very busy and I think we both needed slash wanted a break by doing nothing. I know I did. But the Assembly's back and there's been a lot of political activity that's already happened this week. So we're going to get into it, but yeah, first, before we get into all that, let's catch up with Matt. How's things?
Doing well.
All right.
It's good to be here as always, James.
I know, I haven't done the traditional intro, but
well,
I think I'm...
You threw me a curveball there.
I'm going all postmodern for 2022, we're changing it up.
We're breaking down the structures.
Yeah, no. Who says we need an intro?
This narrative doesn't exist.
Yeah, we're going to go all... Jackson Pollock here, just all out there and crazy.
Just start spraying stuff at the wall and just
hoping
it looks alright.
I don't know if people hate Jackson Pollock's artwork, but I quite like it in a weird way.
I don't think I've ever looked at it for a particularly long period.
It's like
of time.
There's like a really niche reference, but the very best of the Stone Roses, one of their album covers, I think, is the Jackson Pollock.
All right.
Painting, and I seen it on vinyl the other day and it really caught my eye and I've staring off for a good while.
Yeah.
How pretentious is that? So yeah, look, we're just going to go over some of the biggest stories that have happened and give our thoughts on it. It's good for you guys, as I think this is a nice wee summary of the news and you hear some opinions, but it's also good for us, so just trying to keep up with it all and be nice about it in a way that our minds can understand it. So yeah, let's get into it with a double jobbing. You might have heard a good bit about this. This is quite a strange story. It actually originated from the House of Lords. So this is to do with the Petitions, Elections, and Petition of Concern Bill.
Yep.
Which currently go for the House of Lords at the moment. And very interestingly, the way it works in the rest of the UK is that members of the Welsh government, the Scottish government, can have dual mandates. So what that means is that they can sit in the Welsh or Scottish assemblies and also sit in Westminster. This used to be a thing back in Northern Ireland, back in the day, but ever since the expense scandal of the late noughties, I think, or mid-noughties, you know, a while ago, this sort of, you know, brought dual mandate up to the public's attention in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
People were just really against it because, you know, you have politicians who were on like over £100,000, like crazy amounts of money, and saying, well, you can't possibly do both roles. So Northern Ireland was actually, you know, well ahead of the trend. So what the Lord said is, well, we'll make Northern Ireland in line with the rest of the United Kingdom, and then in 2 years, we'll scrap dual mandates for the whole of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
So it's a bit strange why they decided to bring it back.
Yeah.
And the more even interesting fact was Lord Alderdice. For those of you who don't know who Lord Alderdice was, he was one of the leaders of the Alliance Party at the time, the Good Friday Agreement. Very, very influential figure to the whole peace process. And, you know, a lot of his political career was about ending dual mandates. And it's been quite an Alliance trend. Now, in fairness to the Alliance, Lord Alderdice is no longer an Alliance Party member. He's with the Lib Dems. There's a joke there to be made, but I will make it. So
it would have been a good joke.
So Lord Alderdice was the one who helped bring this forward in a sick, twisted way.
Yeah. It was Lord Kane, though, who tried to bring it back.
Yes.
Isn't he a Lord?
Yeah, Lord Kane. So there's the context of how this came about. And this, the BBC only reported this on a Friday night.
Yes.
So it caught a lot of people by surprise. Like even some MLAs when he found it out on Saturday morning.
Came out quite strongly against it. But what I mean is, it's not just the fact it came out. It felt like there was like a strong kind of like reaction to it.
But I remember seeing it on Friday night going, nobody's going to see this. This is going to be a fun weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And it was. So you had every party against it bar the DUP.
Pretty much.
And I think we should go into why the DUP were for it.
Yeah.
So, Lagan Valley, who sits there as an MP?
Who could it possibly be? It would be Geoffrey Donaldson.
Who is?
Both an MP.
And leader of the DUP.
And leader of the DUP.
So, look, we've talked about the Lagan Valley election for a while now. You know, with Geoffrey saying he was going to run as an MLA.
Yeah.
You know, how interesting a by-election would look like. Because what happens is if you are an MP and you step down, a by-election has to occur to elect somebody else. It's not like in Northern Ireland when an MLA steps down,
an assembly,
Yes.
And the assembly versus Westminster.
Yeah.
Two different processes
take
place. Obviously, one's attempting to kind of combat, you know, possible sectarian voting, while the other one's more concerned with kind of like the national, or well, not the national, but the kind of
first past
UK-wide,
the post.
First past the post kind of idea of how you do politics, or how you do elections, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, to be fair, you were talking about, you know, the double jobbing. One of the things that was in the amendment was that it said, I believe you can only, I don't know if it was in the amendment itself or it was kind of like a tag on to it, that you can only take one salary from each of the two.
Mm.
So I think they assumed maybe that that would...
That would curb it enough.
Curb, you know, people's kind of annoyance at it enough.
But
it didn't.
there was the political advantages here is that normally MPs have a much, you know, stronger name in some areas.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about Donaldson being an institution in Lagan Valley.
Yeah.
And how, you know, him having both, there would be no bad situation there for him. And I think a lot of other potential DU MPs in their respective areas were like, oh, this is an easy vote winner.
Yeah.
We can then eventually step down from our assembly role after 6 months and simply just co-opt a junior member on. So effectively kneeling on seats that they might have potentially not got. So it was a very interesting tactic, and the DUP have spent all this political will bashing against the other party, saying, nope, this is perfectly fine, we're going to do it. Only then for the Tory government to be like, no, we're scrapping it, it's not going
to
happen.
Quite obvious reasons why they've decided they don't want the controversy right now. Another controversy, I should say.
Yes, yes. So, Matt, do you think the DUP have shot themselves in the foot for being so gung-ho over this dual mandate process? And it's been... No, because that's a loaded question. Do you just think it's a... They spent a lot of political will defending this, only for it to...
I'm sure they've called,
back in their face.
I'm sure they've called in a few favors on this one. They've kind of had to spend. They've wasted enough of their time now that it probably does look like a bit of a dud.
Yeah.
You know that it also just all occurred so quickly in terms of, you know, it getting turned down from it being announced.
Yeah. From Friday to Wednesday, it was a very quick turnaround.
Yeah. So it's not even like there was actually a real debate around it. It was kind of just like, this isn't going to happen, lads. Like, you're out of luck here. It's not the time for the Tories to say something controversial.
Wouldn't it be the first time the DUP have been hurt by Tory actions?
No. But I mean, the DUP are... I mean, ever since... let's not go too far back in history. But I mean, ever since Margaret Thatcher, you'd say that the DUP has been a wee bit... antsy around a Tory, you would say. It's not necessarily. Well, yeah, I actually do think the DUP probably take a lot of their thoughts on the Tory party from the kind of Thatcher era.
Yeah.
Even though they weren't the in power party, I think they still probably look back at that, because a lot of them probably still have that living memory of it and think, this is the party that keeps on betraying us.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So the double jobbing, it's came and went again.
I mean, that would have made Geoffrey Donaldson both if he got elected, which he would have done if he did get elected.
Yeah, no, it would have been nailed on.
As two people from Lagan Valley.
Yeah.
I mean, there wouldn't have even been a race.
No, he would have been top dog, easily.
Easy. So, like, you know, and also then, they probably would have run Given as well.
Yeah, that you would like to think that would have been guaranteed for them.
Pretty much, like.
And then you would have had Poots.
And then you would have had Poots.
You could have potentially run another candidate if you were ballsy about it.
I mean, I don't know if they could get four years. To be fair, it is Lagan Valley, though.
Yeah, it's like the last DUP stronghold in a lot of ways. saying it. No, I think four.
But I mean, yeah.
If they were being bullish, they could run for it. I don't know if they would. I don't think they would get four.
Maybe the question would be why not?
Yeah, because you were almost.
People would put 1, 2, 3 for Jeffrey Nelson, given Poots. And then the fourth one, you'd just be there like, well, let's see.
Yeah, just we'll be cheeky about it.
Yeah.
You know.
But then I think what I was going to say before is I would have made, if he did get in, it would have been MLA, well, probably either deputy or first minister as well. Yeah. He would have been doing that. He would have been doing MP. And then he would have had these ambassadorial...
Like, yeah, envoy job. To Egypt.
Envoy to Egypt as well would have been... So then that would have probably actually been an impressive amount of work to be doing.
Yeah.
Even though whenever we talked about it before, we said envoy to Egypt probably isn't like...
It's not a massively time-consuming
job. It's not a daily job.
Yeah.
But I mean, along with then having to do... Be effectively the leader of your party, be the head of... Well, a relative, like, head of, you know, an administration, I guess. Whatever way you want to call it, like, yeah. The first minute, the deputy and... The deputy...
The executive office.
The executive office, yeah. And it, then also be an MP...
Yeah.
I mean, you basically have to be three places at once near enough for that.
Yeah, from a practical standpoint, you would have, obviously, the Assembly.
Yeah.
Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday, you would have to be over in Westminster for PMQs.
Yeah.
And then, if he's on the executive, it normally sits on a Wednesday or Thursday.
Mm.
So, it's a lot of work to be doing.
And then maybe every so often, just a wee trip out the...
Yeah, you would...
To the Mediterranean.
In fairness...
He'd rarely do that if he...
Yeah. You know. I thought some of the commentary around it was a bit over the top.
Facetious, maybe.
Yeah, it definitely was when it was coming to the, like, oh, you know, it's so hard to do both jobs, which it is, I'm especially sure, at the
same time. I'm sure it is.
But you have large backroom staff to help you with a lot of the grindy work. So
it's not like he's not an experienced politician either. Like,
he
knows what he would be in for.
Like, it's been done before. Like, you had, like, John Hume did it and all, and David Trimble. Yeah. And, you know, again, the public perception of double-jobbing was a lot different, and the context was very, very different,
yeah.
Especially if we're talking about Hume as a nationalist in the 80s and all. But it's just... Yeah, I thought it was a bit over the top, and I've seen a few of the opposition parties playing up to that a wee bit too much, in my opinion.
I do think MLA is obviously now... It's a more respectable job than it would have been, obviously, maybe like 20 years ago.
I think there's more political expertise within MLAs now.
Yeah.
There's less of this, I'm some fella who's somewhat interested in the politics, and I've had a business for 30 years. It's now... you know.
That's just what MLAs probably used to be. Like,
Like, well, there's still some of them in
there. Are some of them, yeah.
Some up in the DUP, but I won't name names.
Just boys who just decide, like, oh, damn,
I'll have a go with this, you know, because the Lodge dared you to do
it. Very 800s, or, you know... That would have been like MPs would have been like in the 800s, just being like, I may as well become a politician. Like,
yeah, why not?
I'm rich and I'm and I've got time in my hands. Like,
I think if you look at some of the new modern, especially the younger ones who are a lot more politically savvy and have actually studied politics, you know, there's this,
or they've just been interested in it, or they've come through like kind of the grassroots of maybe the parties actually.
Yeah, there's a lot more professionalism around it.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's probably a few out there who actually could probably do the double jumping role. And there is some benefits to double jobbing in a way, because you have much greater access, and then your constituents are more focused on one place, and you have more power and influence in over areas. But the public perception of it is very negative in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And I think it is. I would lean on the side that it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I don't think it should happen.
No.
But I think if you're in... I think if you really are crying out for more work...
There's
then,
a lot
then
more.
You're already doing. Yeah. Then, I mean... Depending on some areas, Northern Ireland, you got a lot of work to do. Like, you've got, you know, if you could easily be putting your time to like better use in your own constituency instead of having to worry about, you know, a separate other job that would take your time away from that constituency.
Yeah. Okay. Well, moving on from double jobbing, but I'm going to bring up a surprise topic as it's just came to my head right now. It's still around the DUP, actually, but I want to talk to you about it. It's a more ideological debate. So Paul Frew was in the Assembly on Tuesday with a public petition about COVID vaccines and how we shouldn't have them. And he brought up this petition from Liberty NI. The newsletter did actually a very good article around this and saying who are they. And they're a very mysterious group. They contacted this group and said, we're not anti-vaccine. We just want people to have freedom of choice. So it's like, it's a very libertarian style group, freedom of choice, do what we want, no government intervention. But I found it interesting how an MLA has taken upon this random group's online petition, an online petition, great. I'm sure that means everything. Has taken this to the highest order of the land to decry vaccines and vaccine passports, I should actually say more accurately. But when we're talking about the DUP, do you think to them this is a reflection that they are in some areas they are a very, not liberal party, libertarian party? And I think that it's a more accurate reflection when describing the DUP at times, because we've seen they are the party that seem to be most against vaccine passports and lockdowns, and they line up very nicely with some of the more right wing elements of the Tory party, for example.
They like negative freedom, you'd say. They're all about the kind of idea of being free from something. And not necessarily free to do something. Which is fine. I mean, I don't actually think that's a ridiculous political opinion to have. And whenever it comes to like vaccine mandates, while I agree with them, I think there's a political debate to be had about them.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to do it like sensibly, I think it's fine. I don't really know. So they just made a petition about it.
They made a petition about it.
Did they do anything else?
No, of course they didn't do anything else. So when the newsletter contacted them, we said we're anonymous and we don't want to say who we are.
What's the point of it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's something that I've thought about a fair bit recently. Is like these, every week you see these boys go out to the front of City Hall and they go and they talk about how much they hate vaccines, and they all get together and a stand and they sing about, how we're all being controlled, and then they have absolutely zero engagement with the political process, which is completely there to change things if you actually wanted to engage in the right way. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like the power, the levers of power, like there.
Yeah.
And you're over the other side of the room being like, why can't I change anything?
Yeah. So it's a politically active movement that doesn't engage with political actors.
Yeah. I feel the same way about some other like groups as well. I sometimes think, like, I look at it like, maybe the Green Movement at times, and I'm there like,
I knew you were gonna say that.
I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but you're doing it like completely away from like anything actually in the political institutions.
But if you're supporting political actors, are you not just part of the status quo and therefore the problem?
No. That's what opposition is.
I mean, it's slightly facetious. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, being anonymous as well and being libertarian is, it's a funny kind of mix.
Yeah, it is.
It's like, I believe in getting to do what I want, but also I don't want my face to be seen.
I don't want the repercussions for my actions.
Like, if you came out and you were there like, I'm libertarian, no one would be like, get out. No one's discriminating against libertarians, right?
I know. But yeah, I find it interesting because Paul Free fascinates me as a character, because I think he is one of the DUP members who is, you can actually describe on a more left or right wing basis.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And for that, I find him probably one of the more interesting members.
Mm-hmm.
And I also find it fascinating that he was our economy minister for, the lifetime of a bit of bread.
Not very long.
Yeah. Very, very short. But it would have been fascinating to see how he would have, dealt with the economy in this very libertarian sense in a part of the world, province, state, whatever you want to call it, which is very reliant on government handouts from London. So, I don't know. I think he's a very interesting character.
He is.
Yeah, that's just my own personal opinions coming through. Don't agree with him, but find him fascinating within the landscape that is Northern Irish politics. Look, moving on, we'll go to the Ulster Unionist Party. We're going back to, where is it? Fermanagh we're going to, I believe.
Is it Tyrone?
Let's see. A County Tyrone UUP official has resigned from the party. So we're all the way in Tyrone. Shout out to all the fellas right there.
Shout out to all our Tyrone boy.
I'm doing like a Hugo Duncan show moment. Skilly eyed, needle eyed, do, or whatever he says. Have you never listened to Hugo Duncan?
No.
Oh, you're not culty enough. So.
I mean, showing up.
Yeah. So look, we've talked about this before. The drama that has happened in Tyrone with Ian Marshall, who was selected by Party HQ and not the association. So what this means is that the association are a wee bit sad that they didn't get to pick their preferred candidate.
Yeah.
They see it as Belfast and the townies having more say over west of the ban, which, by the way, is a very legitimate feeling, west of the ban.
Yeah.
Of, you know, especially the North's institutions being too Belfast-centric. And I think there is very, very legitimate feelings and arguments there.
I don't think that's wrong.
But look, some fallout. We've had an ex-councillor and his wife quit the party. While that story in itself is not interesting, no offence to Mr. McCain and Mrs. McCain.
Yeah.
I think the real interesting story is how ongoing, you know, this problem has been for the UUP with Ian Marshall.
Yeah.
You know, that he's this very progressive, very moderate, somewhat okay of the protocol, potential unionist MLA. Or assembly candidates, let me say, and you have this association that are so against it, and I think this shows really the dichotomy that exists within the UUP at the moment.
Yeah.
You have this new wave, new line, modern liberal thinkers coming in with the likes of Doug Beattie, really wanting to change the imagery of this party, but you have this old guard still violently lashing out, you know, that this is almost like a Lundy sellout.
Yeah.
And it's almost representative of unionism as a whole, I think, in a lot of ways, and how anytime unionism tries to progress itself, it hates itself for trying to do something different and not being the status quo.
Yeah.
So I think that was an interesting story for that, and I'm getting very animated now. You can tell how much this has excited me.
Maybe they should create a vanguard and
Oh, Matt, you're gonna kneecap tonight, son. Who says we don't have fun on this podcast?
It's a callback right there.
It was a good callback.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so a spokesperson for the UUP said the party has selection processes that every aspiring candidate has to abide by the same process. Ian Marshall is a positive, confident unionist who is committed to strengthening Northern Ireland's place in the United Kingdom.
Some man. I mean, I don't understand how the headquarters just haven't sat down and just said, all right, let's just not do this.
Okay.
It's kind of, no, I'm going to make another football metaphor.
No,
I'm not going to do it, no. I'm going to just actually be a normal person for a second. I just wonder if maybe they're thinking, like, if we weather the storm on this decision, if we deal with the fact that some people are going to leave us in that area, that's fine. Because we don't want those people.
Yeah, if I was Doug Beattie, I would just tell him the, you know,
Sod off.
I was going to say F off, but sod off is a better way. Because
yeah.
I think for him,
it's not right to do.
He's somebody who's trying to definitely reform the UUP. He's looking to rebuild it. And I think
so. You don't think there's any possibility of like a kind of Blairite, Brownite kind of forming together of two different identities?
No, I think he knows how broad the UUP is. And I think he's trying to put a mark on it, which moves it slightly more to the left and more liberal.
Because I he's got to lose some people.
Yeah, I think he's willing to sacrifice older members and the old guard, which have, let's be real, in the last 15 years done nothing for that party.
Yeah.
You know, what have they got to say? Their same old way of thinking has went from them from the start of the Good Friday Agreement, which, you know, as a party that was very, very influential into that,
yeah,
to then just increasingly losing votes year on year on year. I think Doug has came in with a real energy and actually inspired a sort of new wave of unionists / potential unionists to re-engage with political unionism. And I think he sees that as far more worthwhile than keeping these old guard folk on.
He's effectively getting rid of the DUP light
Yeah,
in kind of every sense of the EUP.
Yeah, and if you look at the...
But then he's still got like people like Robbie Butler and Andy Allen, who all seem to be on his side.
Mm. Yeah,
who aren't like... They're not left-wing.
No.
But they seem to be perfectly fine.
And well, maybe with Andy, I would argue he's slightly more... Robbie, I know, is very much a centrist.
Yeah, I would say they're both centrist.
Yeah.
But I just mean in the fact that it's not like he's saying, like, anyone who's not looking for communist revolution here, get out. Like, he's quite clearly happy enough to have, like, constructive debate. He's quite clearly allowed to have, like, more than just one very small political identity.
Yeah.
It's just, like, whenever it becomes, like, too far away, maybe he just knows the line.
Yeah, and I think he knows that's the real vote winner, like...
Yeah.
You know, it's
one. I was making a joke as well about the communist revolution.
I know. I see if anybody thinks you weren't joking there, they can stop listening. Yeah. Because a lot of this podcast is going over their head then. But yeah, I think with Doug, it's within that centrist sort of circle. Yeah. I think he's trying to maybe just move the party over.
Just fair.
You know, and
probably needs to be done.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting project. I don't know how well rewarded he will be in this next election, because I don't know if he's had enough time to complete this transformation.
Well, look, it was either doing this or it was just watching the DUP die even slower. So, like,
yeah.
Which one do you really want?
And I think for two parties that are trying to now, for the first time in, I don't know, maybe for the first time since the early noughties, fight for the top position of unionism. And in this election...
Yeah, they're fighting for it.
Hmm?
They're fighting for it. Yeah.
They're fighting for it. I don't think
they're not going to get it. No.
I don't think they'll get it. Being a realist,
they're also just fighting their corner in a sense that they actually have a corner now to fight.
Yeah,
they're not. They're not like trying to set in DUP's corner getting battered. No, no. I'm going to go over this corner.
Yeah, like I hear a lot of the professional commenters saying that, you know, they're trying to win alliance, and that's true to an extent, but I think. They're just trying to also establish their own identity.
Yeah.
Which I think is a much more important battle.
Yeah, no, it is.
Than just trying to nick off a couple of, you know, softy alliance folks who are, like, more accepting of unionism, you know? But, look, I thought that was just an interesting story and an interesting snapshot of the greater debate that's happening there. Next on the agenda, can you tell I've been at work too long? is integrated education bill. Private members bill by Kelly Armstrong of Stratford. This was the longest debated private members bill in the Assembly's history. Over 20 hours.
3 whole days.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Not great. Shouldn't have taken that long.
It's a long time to debate over this one. I mean, it wasn't even the longest piece of legislation you've ever seen. Like,
it's not even that complex.
No, not really. But I mean, there was an awful lot of amendments to it.
Yeah, which we're not going to lie, we tried reading for it and we got lost because it was such small...
It was just there's too many amendments for us to, like, do it in, like, this couple hours we have before talking about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're recording it on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So recording it after it's done and there was, like 10 different amendments and we were just there like, man, there's two.
Yeah, if the BBC didn't report on it, we're not reporting on it, essentially.
They got, like, 10 people to do it. And they're all too lazy to do it, so, like, I'm joking, they're not.
Well, that's just one person working on the BBC team. Let's just these bastards here.
This is war now.
Yeah. Our very small reach and their massive reach.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, it was an interesting bill. Just trying to promote integrated education within society and make it the norm.
Yeah.
We've talked about it before, only 7% of schools here are integrated, which is just crazy.
It is crazy.
Well, we know how, because, you know, it's all very well building an integrated school.
Not in my backyard.
Yeah, and the area itself has to reflect that, and how do you get areas to change? That's a much more difficult procedure.
Isn't there a thing, NIMP, not in my...
I don't know what you're trying to do here.
There's like a saying for it. It's like an acronym.
Not
in my...
NIMBA?
Yeah, so something like that. I don't think it's my backyard. I think it's something. No, NIMBY. Yeah, it is. Why? Yeah, NIMBY.
NIMBY.
Not in my backyard.
Oh, okay.
It's like whenever, you know, people say.
Yeah, yeah. It's like.
They're going to build low. I really like the idea of someone building low income housing.
Yeah, but I don't want to.
But don't do it by me. Like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that drops my property value and that's bad.
Oof, yeah. I've met a few people like that in my life.
I think everyone has.
Yeah, it's somewhat relatable in a way. On some level, you understand them.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, and there's people like I've been guilty of it before as well. Like, so
yeah.
I'm not going to pretend like I'm.
I
perfect.
Think the reason we moved on to that so easily is because whenever it comes down to integrated education, you're kind of just there like. Yeah, it should be a thing.
Yeah,
but like at the same time, how does it work and how do you actually do
yeah,
it?
Yeah, what does it mean to be integrated?
Yeah. Plus, we've already actually talked about the bill itself, I'm pretty sure, before on the podcast.
Yeah, we have, but just a quick summary. I just thought it was interesting how it took so long, and I think it brings up a wider questions within the Assembly of why don't we have electronic voting?
Yeah.
Especially when COVID was happening, I'm sure they could have implemented that.
Would have made a lot more sense.
It would have been a great time to implement it, so...
Yeah. Especially with everything having to modernise and, you know, digitise a wee bit.
Yeah, and with the Assembly under such strain with legislation at the moment, Speaker of the House, Alex Maskey, recently said on Monday there that any bit of legislation that doesn't leave committee stage within the next few weeks, consider it dead.
Which that's going to be a fair...
Fair chunk of legislation.
A fair chunk of legislation that people were really wanting to get through there.
Yeah.
It's not gone through now.
It's quite a shame, actually. So I think there really needs to be a movement towards electronic voting.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think it'd be that hard to implement. Let's be real. Like, there's a lot of other places in the world that have it already. So look, integrated education bill, just thought it was interesting. It's on to the further consideration stage for more amendments and more discussion. So again, we'll continue reporting on that. There is good potential that this actually might come through as legislation. Obviously there's some disagreements within the likes of the DUP, obviously some have been Sinn Féin, I think one or two from the UUP who are not happy with it, but the UUP see integrated education as a different way, as like a one state education system, so in that regard you would lose out on, I think you would potentially lose out on grammar schools.
I don't think
they've been very clear on that. Or I'm just not understanding it. So you would lose out on grammar schools. They would be the same as secondary schools. You would then effectively lose out the Catholic school system.
Yeah.
And I think there's another... The integrated sector, it would just all be the one school state system.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting... it's been a bit of UUP policy for around 100 years, that. And I think if you look at the context of when the UUP was ruling... during the existence of Northern Ireland, that meant very different things. A one school state system.
Because if
you had the UUP in the 1920s, for example, you've just had the formation of Northern Ireland and this unionist supremacist state in some regards. Nationalist listeners are going, no, it was just 100%.
It wasn't proto, it was.
So you would have had like this top-down state oppression almost on the due to the this is the only education you could have.
Yeah.
But now in 2022, 100 years on, what does that look like? The UUP seat is more open and inclusive.
Well, I can see why nationalists wouldn't want that as well. Like,
oh yeah, definitely.
Because I think they've got a very specific identity in their schools that are probably I don't think it's necessarily stronger than it is in unionist schools. I mean, we both went to unionist schools, or schools that were in with, you know, unionist communities.
That's a better way to say it.
Because realistically, the identity within those schools isn't.
Like, there were people
unionist.
From
unionist.
Yeah. I get what you mean.
You know, I see, obviously, because there was such a long period of like suppression of like. Irish identity,
Irish language,
which, Catholic, just in general, like religion. Then I'm kind of there, like I kind of see why you wouldn't want to kind of strip that all away.
What does a Northern Irish education look like in that regard?
What does a Northern Irish future look like if, is the goal to like remove all difference between the two communities? Like, is the idea just to like. Become homogenous, or like, are you allowed to like retain like, you know,
the differences,
cultural, you know, specificity, or like, you know, I don't think our goal should be like, let's, which isn't me saying, you know, I still think that integrated education should be larger and should happen more.
Me too.
But like, I'm also there, like, I mean, let's not, you know, just like try and remove everything that makes, you know, us like a wee bit different.
Yeah, it's like differences that should be celebrated and acknowledged and. Yeah, it's like, do you go for almost like the Bosnian and Herzegovina example where, you know, you have these such differences and you just ignore them. And then when you keep ignoring them, the differences become more and more obvious as time goes by and it flares up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Look, I we just thought it was worthwhile mentioning. Next up, fuel poverty. Matt, do you actually want to take the lead on this? You've done a post about it. And since I'm off all social media at the moment, you're...
Yes.
I haven't seen what you've really said about this.
So, I believe it was a... 2 million. It was 2 million extra that that the Department for Communities was looking for in relation to this kind of like fuel poverty that is kind of hitting Northern Ireland at the moment, or not the fuel poverty. It's hitting it just all of a sudden. Obviously, the fuel poverty exists before and it's getting worse, and now there are also more people who are like kind of more threatened or like on the line of fuel poverty.
Yeah.
With a lot more kind of price increases. Due to various, you know, global, but then also kind of slightly more specifically local effects of like energy.
Yeah, post-Brexit stuff as well.
Post-Brexit stuff.
And then just inflation in general for everything
inflation,
else.
Inflation, you know, probably also just some post-pandemic stuff coming into it. People are now maybe stuck in their houses more with winter as well, obviously.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, you end up using more fuel than you would usually. So they were trying to put more money towards this. I think... It's 200. The it's meant to be
200 million, isn't it?
£200 to 280,000 people. And you are getting it if I believe the list of things that are requirements for you to be getting it is you must be on either like a pension credit, universal credit, income support, income related employment and support allowance, or like job seeker allowance.
So it's people already within the existing benefits.
Yeah,
system.
I do believe like people like Andy Allen were raising concerns of it not being like put out as efficiently as they would have liked, which is like a reoccurring issue within like these kind of schemes that Northern Ireland seems to do.
Well, didn't the department say a max can only take in 300 requests a day, and the website was constantly crashing due to demand?
Yes, which is it's kind of like if you literally know how many people are going to be coming to this.
Yeah,
and it's the same thing that happened with the voucher scheme. You know there's going to be like a lot of people coming to this first thing. I know that to some degree, like with the Northern Ireland voucher scheme, I can kind of appreciate it more because like if a million people hit your page at once, I'm kind of there like, yeah, fine, that's difficult for anyone. Like you know, there's really big companies that haven't been able to deal with that. You know, that's a fair issue. But then whenever it comes to like something like this where I don't think, you know, a million people probably went on the page, I think they're slightly more like accountability as to why it was this so.
Yeah, well, how many people did you say were eligible? Around 200,000, was it?
200,000, yeah, well, near enough 300, yeah.
Yeah, so you have almost 300,000 people who can apply for this.
Yeah.
So let's say 10% of them do it day one.
Let's go a wee bit higher, because let's say it's like 30.
30%, do you reckon? Okay, so that's at 90,000 people. So
maybe just go on it just to see it.
Yeah, just like that's 90,000 people, and you can only do 300 requests a day.
That's great, yeah.
So by the time you get to the people at the end of the queue, winter's over and we're into summer?
Yeah, pretty much.
Great. They won't be cold next winter, but they're going to be cold this winter?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, they're not even like doing it by... There's no like way of saying, oh, who needs it most, I don't think.
Jesus Christ.
From what I've seen, maybe there is, and I just haven't read it. But I don't. From what I was seeing, I didn't see any like kind of preferential treatment towards like the people who need maybe get more, or if there's like a, I don't know. It is. Look, I think you can be too harsh in these kind of situations where it is something that had to be done very quickly. It's something that like hasn't been like, you know, an expected thing that the department had to do. It's got worse very quickly. It kind of has creeped up on us.
But has it creeped up on us?
I think in terms of...
Fuel poverty is not a new thing.
No, it's not a new thing.
We've known about this for years.
But I think the degree of the increases and like how bad it's got in such a short period of time, I don't think we would have expected. I think we would have thought like it would be a wee bit slower to get this bad.
Yeah.
But it's just all... I mean, whenever it came to like the price increase, everyone was there like, how has it gone up this quickly? I know that like my prices have went up. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Like my... One of mine... I think my electric bill is up like 50%. Like it's crazy. Like it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Luckily, I'm like a, you know, a dude who lives on his own, so I can like afford it. It's like not mad for me.
Mm.
But, like I'm sure for like someone who's actually, you know, having to count the pennies properly, it's
yeah, like working parent, couple
yeah,
kids,
working parent, couple know. Kids, maybe single parent, couple kids. Like that's
nightmare situation.
Horrendous. Like that, yeah. That's truly like a terrifying thing to have to think about. And then the government says, "Oh, we're gonna help you out here," and then says, "Oh wait, we can't do that. Sorry."
And then the people who most need government support are the ones that are consistently alienated by its success or lack of success
yeah.
for them.
Yeah.
So then you have this group of people who probably need the most political engagement to better their situation in life and the support. And the only time when they need to access government support, the government can never deliver for them.
Yeah.
So you get more alienated and more frustrated, and it's
here we are.
Ever developing cycle.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, it's a good issue that we're talking about. Just thought we'd make you aware of what some people in our society are going through.
It is what it is.
Yeah, sadly. Green politics. Again, this is something you wanted to discuss. What do you mean by green politics in Northern Ireland at the moment? What's happening? I know we just had the environmental consultation close.
Yeah, with the strategy, yeah.
Yeah, and what, 30 organisations said it wasn't ambitious enough?
30, exactly, I believe it is, yeah. I think it's 30 exactly.
It was 30 exactly.
Yeah,
because I read that story this
morning.
Thank
you very much. Yeah, all saying it's not ambitious enough.
Not promoting woodland coverage, I believe, is one of the main.
One of the main ones that I think was being discussed, which is also weird because recently Poots did have a scheme about like highlight. It's not a scheme. I think he was just highlighting kind of the single use plastic issue of like there being too much use of single use plastics.
Yeah, it's because carrier bags are gonna go up to what, like 15p or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Maybe more.
And then there's multi use plastics as well. They're not like used as much and all this kind of stuff. But obviously that's kind of a big environmental part of it. We've got two climate change bills going through. We've got fracking going through. We had the energy strategy last month. This meant to take us to net zero by 2050.
Yeah, by the way, the industry is tearing itself apart over that, by the way.
Yeah.
it's not going to look great.
I mean, we'll see what happens with it, but
yeah,
it's a very ambitious bill, or it's a very ambitious strategy.
Which we're nowhere near ready
which
for.
Which we're nowhere near ready for, and which almost does assume, I think it does assume on some stuff happening that I don't think is necessarily possible at the moment. But I mean, I still think, you know, if we're going to reach net zero by 2050, it has to be looked up. You know, the possibilities have to be looked at, and we have to do the best thing that we can.
Yeah.
And then we've got, I already said about fracking, I haven't said about the micro generator stuff, and, you know,
that was John O'Dowd's, if I remember spell from
yeah, I believe
small
so.
Scale green energy bill.
Yeah. Yeah, then they've got like the Alliance Party coming out with just a specifically like 30, 40 page document just saying about how they want to tackle like environmental policy making and green policy making and green industry. This is a real issue now.
Yeah.
This is not like a potential, this is not like a theory.
Mm-hmm.
A green politics, not in the sense that, oh, everything we're doing right now is going to be green. The sense that a green political discourse of whether, how we do it, where we go, should we do it,
yeah,
will it happen? Like, is it like here, today, now, like it's in our faces?
I might know for listeners. Yeah, just, it's, we just don't have the infrastructure. We're ill-prepared, and any future planning I see, it says all the right things, but then the industry kicks up a fuss about it, and we're getting nowhere. Like, the next big issue you're going to see over this mandate, I think, with the increased purchasing of electric vehicles, is
right.
We just don't have the charging network.
Yeah.
Like, it just does not exist.
No, it doesn't.
Next time you're on the roads, see how many electric chargers you see.
It is the most legitimate argument you get with green politics, or with, like, the kind of green changes, environmentalism, is, like, it does sometimes rely on not only infrastructure, but on science that isn't like all the way there yet.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like, you know, green energy and stuff, some of it's just not efficient enough for us to like actually rely on it society wide.
Yeah. It's good for like the odd person or two.
Yeah.
For those that can afford it.
Yeah.
But for the mass public, and then people drag their heels in.
And then you've got stuff like even the idea of net zero relies on us being able to take, I believe, carbon out of the atmosphere and stuff like that.
Yeah.
which we don't have the technology for, but is assumed that at some point we'll have the technology for by 2050, hopefully.
Also requires us to completely retrofit our homes.
It does, yeah.
I'll tell you what, see homes that are being built now to standards that are environmentally friendly, in quotation marks, are going to need retrofit. So you're building new houses that aren't even ready for net zero.
Yeah.
Continuously. It's.
I mean, and that's what the government's saying by 2030 that they're going to have, like, all buildings going forward from that point, I believe, are going to be net zero.
And then you also have an industry that is just like, no, this cannot be done yet. We are not ready.
But you see, the thing is, that's kind of the... Talk about my article, James.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go on.
Oh, it's as if there was a plan.
So, segue.
Just a tiny little... I'm going to slip this in here, James. this is what I was talking about. The argument on green politics is no longer about, is climate change real? Should, like, it, you know, the believers and the deniers.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, oh, is this economically possible? Is this something that's affordable? How are we hurting people right now by doing this? Like, you know, if we take something as, like, primordial as resource management and energy, and we say, oh, you're going to be cold this winter because we need to change, you know, the way we do energy.
Yeah.
And that's going to mean price increases, and that's going to mean that you probably aren't going to be able to pay your bills. Are you all right with that? Like, like, are you not going to have a populist reaction off of the back of doing that? And that it's an effective, like, shift in, like, Overton's window. Very theory-based and all this. That, like, you've moved from this, like, complete denial to, I'm trying to convince you that climate change is real, to, I accept climate change is a thing. I just don't think it's, like, the most important thing. We should still, like, take other stuff into effect.
Yeah.
And then the other group says, now, no, this is the only thing that matters.
Mm-hmm.
This is us. We have to deal with this every second of every day.
Yeah.
Now. It's sacrosanct to them. It's a religion.
Good use of the word.
Yeah, it's a good use. But, like, it's like a very sharp change. The comparison that I make in the article is Evan Poots, like, the person who put forward the kind of secondary, like, response climate change bill.
Yeah.
10 years ago, just would have said climate change isn't real.
Which, for the DUP, that was some member stance.
If we take, like, just the like, idea of Evan Poots and we transport it to 10 years ago and place it in that time, he would have just said, I don't believe in climate change.
Yeah. Well, maybe he would.
Maybe he wouldn't have. Maybe, look, that's... I'm not...
For slander or just being clear?
Yeah. He did not.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, like, theoretically, if you took, like, the kind of mold of politician that Evan Poots is from 10 years ago... He probably wouldn't have, like, been most concerned. He would have said, no, agriculture, that's more important.
Yeah.
We're the ones who are helping society. We're the ones who are like, feeding you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to do? Hurt us?
Yeah.
Now we're 10 years down the line, and there's some acceptance of the fact that, we have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I agree climate change is a thing, and we're going to try and do something about it. But, I mean, I'm not going to, like, you know, kill the industry that I, you know, came from or grew up in for the sake of it, but I accept the fact that it's a real thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we're seeing with, like, a lot of, like, this kind of stuff is, like, you know, like with fracking, you know, we're seeing, like, people be like, I don't agree with fracking, but, like, at the end of the day, isn't it going to make us money?
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with, or I agree with the idea of, like, you know, being net zero, energy wise by 20, or not just energy wise, but overall by 2045, but, like, how is that going to harm my business? Get me that, and, like, I appreciate it. I just find it, like, I don't want to use another really airy fairy theory.
Go on.
It's got a lot of syllables. it's the algophobic mentality and the palliative society.
Matt, for listeners who aren't as intelligent as yourself, including me, what does that mean?
The algophobic. Algophobia would be, like, the fear of pain, and then, like, palliative would be, like, tackling the cause of the pain, or tackling the pain itself, but not tackling the cause of the pain.
Okay.
it's like palliative care. Like, we're going to deal with your pain, but we're not going to deal with the root of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, okay.
And I guess the idea with most palliative stuff, although I'm not a doctor here, but I assume the idea is, like, you're maybe going to die here, but
yeah,
we're going to make it, like, easier if you
yeah,
like,
yeah,
deal
yeah.
with it. But then you get, like, stuff like the opioid crisis where it's, like, we're going to give you this painkiller even though we could, like, help you deal with your actual, like, root cause.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a painkiller for your headache.
Yeah.
And we're just going to actually make it worse by not dealing with
it. We're not treating with it. You're just delaying it in a lot of ways.
I think that kind of is what, like, the core of this kind of debate feels like at sometimes is, like, are you prepared? Is our political system even capable of, like, dealing with a short-term pain to kind of see, like, a longer-term pleasure, I suppose?
Yeah. I don't really have a response to that because I need to go away and think about that. But it's a very good question. Maybe something people should reflect on. Look, last topic for...
Probably wrong, but...
No, I really think there's some good thoughts there. Look, last topic of today's episode.
Today?
El Barth.
What a man.
Is he leaving or is he staying? I don't know.
That's what I want to know.
I want to ask you.
I mean, did you follow the kind of whole, what did they call it? I thought it was like a really derogatory way of saying it. The pork pie puts or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to hear about
it? No, I don't know. I've heard of that term.
It was never like the, do you know the Red Wall conservatives?
Yeah.
They were apparently going to put in a motion of no confidence.
Oh, pork. Oh, yeah. Okay, I see that.
So, because they're from the north,
yeah,
they call it pork pie puds.
Did, like, some London journalists call it this?
I think it was the Mirror who said it first, and then the Daily Mail picked up on it. The people blamed the Daily Mail, and it was there, like... I mean, it wasn't the Mirror who said it first. I will happily slander the Mail, though, if we get the chance.
I'll slander the Mirror. I just,
yeah, that's what it is. But then I think it just became the thing that people started calling it because I was on the BBC and I was there like, all right, well, people are just calling it that now.
That's a woeful name.
It's not a great name. Like, I mean, because I'm pretty
sure
someone...
you're from the north, you must like pies.
I'm pretty sure someone from, like, Leeds and, like, south of Leeds and all that, and they're like, it's not even that far north. It's like... I don't know. I don't know what the divide is in England as to what is considered officially north.
I think there's a lot of debate around what is the north.
I think there is a lot of debate. I think that's like...
It's quite interesting.
I think there are some parts that get quite annoyed if they get called the north.
Yeah, I think I heard it best explained. It's like a diagonal line almost.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's not even like straight?
No. It's quite an interesting...
That's quite annoying to me.
And it's interesting to see what people call themselves and how they see themselves and how they see others around them. And what are the factors of it.
Yeah. And I'm not going to explain the parties because the party, everyone knows about the parties, don't they?
Yeah.
Everyone, if you're not like Google it, Google Boris Johnson party, I feel like you're going to see a myriad.
Which one?
Yeah. Which one was the best? Top 10 Boris Johnson parties. But then also, you obviously then have this morning, when we're recording this, it was today, the defector moving from the Conservative Party to the Labour Party.
First time since
MP
2008.
First time since 2008, which was back in the... that would have been
Brown.
Would have had to be Brown.
Yeah.
The Conservative moving to the Labour Party again, I believe.
Yeah. So.
And that then led to... I don't think it was directly... I think after the puts, I think this might have... And the parties, obviously, but I think the faction probably just, like... It was all just like this big building up to, wasn't it, David Davidson?
Yeah, saying you, for God's sake, man, you're doing nothing.
Yeah.
Go. And in reference to what he said at the Chamberlain or something.
I know Cromwell said originally to effectively become dictator. That was the very original one. And then there was, I don't think it was Churchill himself said it.
No, but somebody said it at the Chamberlain.
Somebody said it at the Chamberlain, and then that meant the Chamberlain had to go, because as soon as it was said, like, it was off.
Davidson, former Brexit minister?
Yes.
If I believe rightly.
Under Theresa May?
I think it was under Bojo.
It might have been Bojo.
Sure, yeah.
I can't remember which one it was. But yeah, no, like, there's so many, how can you tell? That it was, I mean... I do feel like you could have seen this a mile away in terms of, like, it was only a matter of time before, I think, because so much of the Tory party kind of didn't really even like Boris Johnson in the first place.
Yeah, because he was a populist.
He was a populist, and he was also seen as, like, you're only here because you won a civil action. Like,
yeah.
That's the only reason we like you in the first place, is because you won a civil action.
Yeah, and look, you've had some... I don't know if you've had significant members revolt against him, but you've had...
No.
Some notable examples. So Douglas Ross as Tory leader in Scotland.
Yeah.
Calling for his resignation. And, like, as much as I disagree with Jacob Rees-Mogg, but when he said, you know, he's not that influential a figure, I was like, yeah, he's sort of right.
I mean, he's not. Like,
you're a Scottish Tory, like you and, what, four of your mates.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is taking a swing at your own, like, party, which, I mean,
yeah,
in itself.
Yeah, it's significant enough.
It, not only that, it's, like, the fact that you then replied to it also just suggests that I'm like, all right, okay, so the Tory party internally is just taking, you know, taking pieces out of each other, like,
yeah,
they're all biting at each other at this stage, like...
Yeah. Like, you've seen no ministers, maybe one minister, but, like, a junior minister.
Yeah.
And I don't think, none of the real front bench.
No, I mean, I think it's...
left, yeah.
It's relatively significant, the fact that the faction came from a group of politicians who effectively owe their place in the parliament to Boris Johnson. Like, the Red Wall.
Yeah, it's ballsy for them.
The Red Wall is, like... linked to Boris Johnson, like, surely.
Oh,
in terms of the Tory party.
It's Boris Johnson's people.
And those are the people who just turned on him.
Like, he's turned on many others.
Yeah.
You know. But, yeah, Boris, do you think he'll be gone?
It's hard to tell. I think, you would think it is, because, like, how do you come back from this? How, like, you've lost, I think, we all know who the people are who have now defected in your party. We know what we know that you've actively lied to the public. We know that your party is like has like this new kind of or has reemerged like this internal division.
Yeah.
But like, what's the actual like? I don't even know if they really could pass a no confidence against him though. Still,
I think you need one more scandal to come out.
Yeah.
Really,
I think if Sunak came out and said leave, I think he would have to, because then everyone would just back Sunak.
Yeah, I think maybe Rishi's, you know, like one of the photos came from like his part of the office and everything, so it's somebody in his camp was thinking ahead.
I think he would be,
you know,
he'd probably be very, would he be the youngest
Prime Minister?
No, youngest Conservative leader.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure there's like examples from like the
60s,
so it's like in their 20s or
no,
whatever.
No, you're right. Yeah, probably from.
And I think I think there was one prime minister who was like 22 or something, like back in the day.
Pitt the Younger was pretty young, like.
Pitt?
Pitt was pretty young.
Yeah, no, I think Pitt was one of the younger ones, like 24 or 22, I know.
Yeah.
Let's look it up. Let's take a guess.
Let's take a guess. Well, I'm going for Pitt then.
Yeah, I want to go for youngest UK prime minister. I'm
trying to think of other young ones.
What is Pitt's full name?
Pitt the Younger, but I don't know what it was like.
Oh, the youngest Prime Minister to be appointed was William Pitt the Younger on 19th of December 1783 at the age of 24. Hey, not we're failures, we're not Prime Ministers.
That's madness. Like, but then Prime Minister wasn't even really the same thing back then, to be fair.
Oh yeah, no, it was very different.
Prime Minister was just back then you trying to like be pretty chummy. Well, no, this is over exaggeration, but it was so like reliant on the monarch and all, and you having a good relationship with the monarch.
I actually know really nothing about early prime ministers. Do you know who the first prime minister of the
Walpole?
Oh, good knowledge.
I literally told you I listened to like I'm listening to this podcast series that like goes through each of the prime ministers.
Yeah, I need to listen to that. That's all.
It's actually pretty well. It's all right. It's got issues. There are times where there's like there'll be like one prime minister who served for like a year and they'll have like 50 minutes on him and they're like, nah, just don't care. Like,
are you trying to tell me you're not really into the history of Henry Pelham?
No, I'm not into Bonner, mate. Bonner. Bonner is
my... Oh, behave.
Oh, behave.
William Pitt. Look, I think that wrapped up everything for this eclectic episode.
This is a very eclectic.
I feel good about this one.
I was happy about it.
I like this. This is a good start to the year.
This is a good way to start the year.
It was calm, it was chill, and it was funny.
It was just a wee chat.
I love our wee chats.
I know. So I think it would be cool if we got other political people to do it in person, but it's just like a chat. It's not like
an
interview.
Yeah, I prefer just chatting with serving politicians. I think they're... You get more out of them like that way because their guard's a bit down, but if you're not actively attacking them...
It's like whenever you're dating... and on the... What was it? What's the Irish talk show?
Oh, Joe?
No, talk show. The Southern Irish talk show.
Yeah, Joe's the one I'm thinking of.
No, like on TV.
Oh, fuck.
The Tonight. Know. No, it's not the... The Late Show, isn't it? It's the Late Show.
Yeah.
Wasn't it... There was a time the European... the Irish European Commissioner went on and effectively exposed that he had been...
Yes, I know what you're on about. Yeah, it was late.
He'd been... there was a wee expense scandal going on.
Yeah, was that with Gay Byrne presented at the time?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's a good, have you ever watched a YouTube video on that?
I think I watched it like ages ago.
Yeah,
it's a good video. Like.
Before we close this episode, who's the longest serving Prime Minister of all time?
Oh, you're testing me. It's not Churchill. It's not Margaret Thatcher. Is it Margaret Thatcher?
She's up there, but no.
No, it's not Blair. It's one of the older ones.
Blair is up there as well.
It's not Gladstone. It's not this.
Gladstone is up
there. Gladstone's up there, like.
You're getting quite a few of them in the upper echelon.
Is it? David Lloyd George. No, it's not.
No, Lloyd George isn't. Is he on this list?
Who was the longest? He's one of the older ones, isn't he?
One of the ones you previously said.
What? I've said so far? Am I guessing?
No.
All right, no.
Do you want me to...
Bar?
No. So Robert Walpole, the first one?
Oh, was it really? He's...
20 years. Term in office.
One term. That's because I wasn't really in office back then.
Apparently. Nah, it was something
like that. It was just like... It was like a colloquial, like... Well, it wasn't colloquial, but like people kind of just called you Prime Minister. But he said he was a first among equals, I believe.
Yes, that was the quote.
Yeah.
That's A-level politics coming back there. Okay, everybody. Yep, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.